Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome to a brand spankin' new season of Horror Hill. I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody. And for our season premiere episode tonight, we've got a fresh story from a favorite author of mine, J.R. Hamintaschen. Good old J.R. has a knack for odd takes on horror. Many of his stories revolve around bizarre and strange circumstances that are actually secondary to scathing statements about the human condition, and tonight's tale is a prime example of that, in my opinion. With a title like, I'm a good person, I mean well, and I deserve better, you know that you're in for a bit of a ride. The setup alone is unique enough that I almost want to use it as a writing prompt to share with fellow authors. Picture this. You're out on a date at a restaurant. A fourth date, actually, with all the mental turmoil and second-guessing that goes along with it. Then, out of nowhere, the worst happens and you need to make a hasty, pants-grabbing dash for the bathroom. How embarrassing! How terrible! What could possibly make this situation any worse? Well, for one thing, a recently fired prep cook could have suddenly become endowed with the power to manifest monsters at will, and he could be on his way to enact revenge. But what are the odds of that happening? You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author J.R. Hamintaschen, I give you, I'm a good person, I mean well, and I deserve better. Robin looked nice tonight. She was dressed in an effervescent dress that, while not tight-fitting, at least acknowledged the appeal of her petite form and hearty bust. She had applied a little bit of makeup and eyeshadow, too. Bryce preferred the au naturel look, but the eyeshadow gave her a hint of an edge, a little sass. She had pretty eyes, and the eyeshadow feminized her, tilted the appeal of her androgynous, vulpine beauty back firmly to the feminine side of things. Her hair was done the usual way, pinned up in the back, which he liked. He liked the crook in her nose, the nose that most girls, her included, probably grew up feeling ashamed and insecure about. An asshole could say it looked like there was an extra bone in place of where the cartilage should be. But everything about her was decisively cute, and her nose was that kind of charming imperfection that, in their brief foray into dating, he'd firmly identified with her and maybe even fetishized a little bit. She wore rouge lipstick, noticeable but modest. Red was the color of lust, he'd read in an article, and that bode well of her interest, he thought. That, and that she agreed to a fourth date with him, this time an unabashed date, a full meal and everything. But he tried not to get too ahead of himself. That was emotionally dangerous. His mind was always analyzing the odds. Rouge and a dinner date. Good signs. But this was an unusually early dinner, 6:15 p.m., more befitting of the senior citizen early birds than a couple in their mid-30s. And they were the earliest of the early birds. There were literally no other guests, and they'd arrived at that weird liminal phase where the wait staff was still setting up a bit, and were resentful that you cut down on their time to prepare. But maybe he shouldn't read too much into the time. Maybe she just liked eating early. Hell, he liked eating early. But his mind refused to turn off, always the dating thresher, churning in input and spitting out conclusions. He met her there, which was always a smart bet. Don't want to waste needed conversation talking points on the pre-dinner repartee. That's time you can't control. Imagine having to wait for a table for an hour and spending all that awkward, uncomfortable, impatient time together. So he was already there when she showed up, sitting at the table. When she arrived, he bounded up and pulled her chair back for her. It was simultaneously genuine, yet ironic, which was a fairly good description of how they both had separately represented themselves on their kettle of fish pages. Ah, what a gentleman, she smiled, ironic in her use of gentleman, and what a hoary cliché pulling out a lady's chair was, but genuine in appreciating his interest and his effort, at least, to impress. Pulling out all the stops, are we? Watch out. Ha, you know it. They made small talk for a bit, and he pointed out the drinks menu. She perused it, and he didn't say much. Let her read it, he thought. But that was just displacement. He just didn't know what to say. That was one of his bigger fears, not saying enough. He felt he was an interesting person, but too often all that interesting stuff was buzzing around in his mind and he didn't let it out. Dating and sharing and intimacy didn't come naturally to him. He didn't feel comfortable with it until he knew he wasn't being judged, that he was loved and appreciated. In a sense, he put the cart before the horse. He needed the adulation, and then he felt comfortable with the sharing intimacy. The fact that women expected sharing, intimacy, and the connection before the adulation was a fatal lapse in his emotional sequencing. Did you know? Oh boy, goddamn the man who begins a conversation with "did you know" or "know what's interesting?" That the word Jeep comes from the abbreviation used in the Army for the general purpose vehicle, GP. She worked as an analyst for a car company. Yep, you can take that fact into the boardroom. Promotion, here I come. Yeah, thank the internet and a slow day of work. He had to be careful. Dead air tended to turn him into an interesting fact generator. Could be good for a cocktail party, but no girl wanted to fuck the human embodiment of Wikipedia. Well, she drawled, let me one-up you. Okay, I'm game. Let's hear it. So, you know what the Q in Q-tip stands for? Nope, he said with metaphorical open arms. Quality, she said, throwing up her hands like a rap baller. Well, look at that. The drinks came, and this was pivotal. After she went in for her first sip and after they cheersed, she smiled upwardly from her drink at him in a way that froze his insides and made his heart stop. Inadvertently, it apparently not being enough that she agreed to a fourth date, he'd subconsciously been dedicating mental processing power to monitoring all the signs she was into him. Hair teasing, forthcoming laughter, steady eye contact, running the metrics behind his eyes like an undercover economist. But he needn't worry. That look sealed the deal. It was a look of joy, of the pure sensual pleasure of enjoying another's company and being open to the electricity of good companionship. It relieved him and unnerved him. He wished he could change his reductive thinking. She was a human being, a great human being, for God's sake. He should stop with these objectifying comparisons. But all he could think was that he was a dog who finally catches the car and doesn't know what to do with it. He wanted to tell her that he really liked her and that he wanted to save this moment in time in case something went wrong later in the date so he could backtrack to this moment and start again, like the beginning of a stage in a video game and he'd stocked up infinite lives. Of course, if he did say that, he'd fuck everything up, and, accepting the logic of his own premise, would have to jump back in time to right before he said those words. He sipped his cocktail, gin and bitters and lime and sugar and a fancy name that added $5 to the price. And he liked it, but that didn't even register because he was acting like drinking was something that just got in the way of talking. "Know what else is interesting?" he said, kicking himself mentally for it. He hadn't even swallowed fully before he started. "No, tell me." He detected a less enthusiastic reception than before. "Well, I don't want to just spout out interesting facts, but bear with me. This one is interesting." "Raising the stakes. You better deliver." And she leaned in such a way that the menu pressed against her dress to make a steeple of her cleavage. He never averted his gaze from her eyes. It was just a lovely detail he noticed in his periphery. "Well, do you know that they never toast in Hungary?"
"No."
"Well, and I don't know if this is true, but it's what I've been told."
"Duly noted."
"Told, you mean on the streets?"
"Yes, of course, the streets. The streets are always talking about Hungary."
He was performing that weird obligation to generate witty repartee, and he found it a little bit annoying and disruptive when she joined in. This was a solo act. He was doing his best to even remember the factoid, which was hazy and half-remembered. Was it that they only didn't toast over beer?
Well, after the Hungarian Revolution against the Habsburg Empire in, like, the 1850s, the Austrian army leaders executed the Hungarian generals, and they celebrated it with a toast. So from then on, Hungarians never toast when they drink beer.
"Interesting, interesting." She made a face that registered her appreciation, like she was storing the information. "What was the Habsburg Revolution?"
He sipped and shrugged. "I don't know. If they want me to know, they need to tie it in with some beer or food-related fact or something."
"Obviously," she smiled. The performance ritual of repartee was draining his mental battery. It's interesting how things are considered mildly unpleasant, and then something comes along to drop the end out from under you and make things so much worse. Here he was, juggling being charming with a mild headache, his mild self-hatred of his dating game-playing and his wavering about whether dating as an activity was even worth the effort, his desire just to declare his affections for her and move on to the next steps, and all the other tests to his endurance, when the bottom fell out. The mysteries of the human body. There's a nesting fullness you feel when you need to move your bowels, but that's usually the key. Fullness. A fullness like a shifting tractor trailer. There's weight there. Not this. This was a water hammer in a sewer pipe. This was a seventh grade earth science lecture on potential to kinetic energy. This was his asshole puckering up with flop sweat in the midst of turning into a swamp. This was the type of shit you fooled yourself into thinking you could control with the proper positions you assumed and the seasoned contortions of your asshole, but in reality, you knew it was going to come out hot and burning, and for a second you'd think, "Jesus, what have I been doing with my life?" His stomach gurgled. He kicked himself for his early, mid, and late morning coffees, for those unneeded shots of vanilla hazelnut-flavored chemicals he'd added to them. The sour sludge inside him turned his hunger off like a light switch. There's that pyramid of needs. Hunger, water, those are on there at the bottom, the base of the pyramid. Young guys will act like sex is there as well. But look lower down in the footnotes section, there's a caveat. The need to shit rules out all other needs. He yearned to return to the gentle patter of conversation he'd established. Like an old man on his deathbed, how foolish he was for not realizing how good he'd had it not so long ago. He was a strategic man by nature, especially where something important was concerned, a job, school, a significant other.
He had the tendency to break down every action into a play-by-play like a coked-out John Madden, until it was usually just him alone and a trusted friend hashing out and debating what exactly happened long after the opportunity came, went, or passed, and everyone else had moved on. One of his long-standing life hacks: never go to the restroom before you order food. This didn't just apply to dates. It's inefficient, and the other party will be impatiently waiting for you to return and be doubly attentive to the passage of time. He resumed saying something, under the quixotic delusion that he could flag down a waiter and put in a food order before he had to take the bathroom out of commission. Nope, there'd be none of that. "I'll be right back," a line which, if their relationship survived some length of time, was destined to become an inside joke euphemism. He retired to the restroom before they had even gotten dinner menus. Before they had even gotten dinner menus! He thought of that word, retired, and it seemed apt, because after this, he'd have to take a nap and perhaps retire from ever showing his face in public again. He navigated his way to the restroom, a couple members of the staff intuiting the urgency just beneath the placid mask of his face and pointing him in the right direction. "Les latrines," the sign on the door read, complying with that unwritten rule that every restaurant above a sufficient level of hipness was required to have some whimsical name for the place where people pissed, shat, farted, ralphed, applied and reapplied makeup, and maybe did coke. He twisted the knob on the door, and it didn't turn. Oh God, occupied, and it's only one stall. One stall for every man, woman, and child. Providing one unisex stall should be a crime against restaurant design. Under almost all circumstances, he wouldn't have the guts to shit in a unisex stall, only allowing himself to pee and maybe later squeak out silent farts at the dinner table if the pressure got too bad. He could just never bring himself to defecate where there's only one unisex stall. The pressure was just too much for him. He'd immediately imagine a line of innocent, angelic American Apparel models lining up right outside. He remembered his own traumatic experience at a Barnes & Noble many years ago. Barnes & Noble must have known that every customer secretly resented it for some reason or another, and then tried to appease them by providing a separate bathroom for men and women. But not the Barnes & Noble he'd ventured into. No, not that Barnes & Noble. This must have been a closing Barnes & Noble, where management said, "Fuck it, we'll show these ingrates, make it a unisex bathroom." He'd never forget the look on that beautiful woman's face after he came out of that Barnes & Noble bathroom. Her pixie-ish, dirty blonde hair, her button nose, her button-up shirt that looked so cute on girls of her type, her angular cheeks flush with rouge, the nose ring stud, that little indication that in other circumstances she'd be cool and understanding and open-minded. And that unconscious twitching of her nose, that look of dread and embarrassment and shame that registered knowing that this filthy creature in front of her had just befouled the space she was entering. A creature of honeyed charms and fairy dust entering a labyrinth of emanations bespeaking pestilence and contamination. He twisted the knob before him again, and it opened, albeit slowly, with another person opening the door on the other side. She was trying to twist the door open from the other side at the same time, and they'd been working at cross purposes. "Sorry about that," he nodded and slid past her. "My bad." She wore flannel and had night black hair. Other than that, he couldn't see much of her, but she seemed nice and big-hearted. He made his way in, and lo and behold, he was wrong in his estimation. There were actually two bathroom stalls. One with a... What the fuck is this? There was a trend in restaurants to convey the crucial information of man or woman through quirky signage. That may have made sense at certain themed bars. If you see a male pirate or a mermaid on the bathrooms at a seafood restaurant, well, that's pretty intuitive. But here, one room labeled Mars with the Mars symbol, a circle with an arrow pointing northeast in red, and another door labeled Venus with the Venus symbol, a circle with a cross below it, in light blue. God, he had to be a fucking astrologist here in order to take a shit? Which was which? What other purpose is there of signage than to be clear and direct? Literally, the point is to convey a message clearly. That's why a stop sign reads stop, instead of representing a cleverly illustrated parable of a before, present, and after situation. Venus rhymes with penis? Could that be it? No, he felt that the jutting arrow was a proxy for the penis, and even if that was wrong, society still felt comfortable gendering colors, and light blue usually denoted the feminine. He tried Mars, and it opened. His asshole almost gasped in relief upon entry. There was an undeniable rush, a dampening of the back of his underwear. Why? Did his body just think that when the button comes undone and the pants come out, it can just spray shit everywhere like a fire hydrant? Mind over matter. Mind over matter. His bowels protested with each second, and in the anticipation of impending release was an unspoken euphoria and satisfaction that society dare not name. Alexander, he decided. He would call himself Alexander. It made him feel smart and cultured, and tales of conquest and adventure were the only things he ever enjoyed about high school. Alexander the Great had conquered, like, the entire known world at the time, just went on in and rolled all over people. That would be his inspiration. He took long, reflective pauses as he walked the several miles in the fading natural light toward the deer and fox, as befitting a conqueror debating his options. He put his fingers to his chin, softly stroking a beard that was not there, just staring off into the distance. 1 second, 5 seconds, or 30 seconds, it made no difference. He wasn't actually thinking anything, just assuming the position. He crested the hill overlooking his destination. Alexander, formerly Stephen Acevedo, the unloved, overworked, and underappreciated former line cook at the Deer and Fox, prepared to stride into battle. Let the history books forget how he arrived this day, the undignified means of last resort, literally walking several miles along the shoulder of Route 6. Let the royal decrees leave that out. Stephen's broke ass seeking his revenge on foot, all those cars full of spoiled housewives giving him dirty looks because walking in suburbia is for poor people, and because God forbid this town have a working bus system. Stephen's car had been out of commission for over 2 months now. His car troubles were a source of inexhaustible amusement to the rest of the staff. "Is his car back on the road yet?" someone in the kitchen would ask, as if he wasn't right there. "Close," someone would reply. "It's in the driveway." Even the people who didn't speak English would join in on that. It was a joke to everyone, from the manager, who was supposed to be fair and impartial, who was supposed to put a stop to that sort of harassment, and maybe if you fucking paid me a little more, I'd have the car on the road and be able to make it on time, to the pretty hostesses, to the others in the kitchen who were supposed to be his family. He'd laugh off the jokes at first and tease back, but he wasn't good at it. He was too transparent. It was obvious how much it burned him up. He'd liked working as a cook. He'd read books about the industry. There was supposed to be a sense of camaraderie between all the staff. And he'd been there longer than most. Granted, there was a high turnover. But there didn't seem to be enough deference. A couple of people teased him, and all the new guys thought it became the thing to do, the bypass for bonding. And then, to think, all the people he would bum rides from quit or left town in a matter of weeks, and he had no way to get on time other than the impossible, terrible bus system. And he was late enough times, and he was fired, just like that. All those motherfuckers still talking about him, no doubt. He doesn't have anything. No education, no family, no nothing, except that job. And where were they? They were supposed to be family, right? They sweat together, hustled together, bled and burned their skins together. And he was good at it, goddammit. As much as everything about it sucked, he loved that place. He looked down at hands outstretched before him and watched the forms take shape. He had what appeared to be an undulating baseball poking out just beneath his skin, cresting and falling like a lapping wave. He pivoted and flexed his sore right thumb. Black mist sprayed out with each flex. It reminded him of a cartoon choo-choo train belching smoke. It even made a faintly audible gusting sound, like a stuffed nose on a winter's day. He didn't know if he chose to make that noise, willed it, or if whatever was allowing him to do this had access to some remote memory of a cartoon choo-choo train and fashioned this to amuse him. He didn't care, really. He'd woken up one day, having already come to terms with it. He'd been fired 10 days ago. He'd spent the first weekend getting drunk and feeling sorry for himself, cursing this place. Monday, he found himself instinctively waking up for his morning shift as if he needed to be somewhere. Then, one day that week, he looked in the mirror and saw one of those composite posters looking back at him. There are those posters. He didn't know how they were made or how to describe them. But those posters were one larger, identifiable image was made up of several smaller images of the same person in different poses. Half the time, the subject of the poster was Bob Marley for some reason. He didn't know why. Well, that had been him one morning, except the smaller images weren't him, but a shoulder comprised of egg-shaped black orbs, beady eyes of succulent blueberries, a tornado of angular, writhing shapes for a torso. He had opened his mouth in surprise, convinced this was a dream, but still playing along, and his tongue was an oversized, squamous brick, yet still somehow fit fine in his mouth. Tendrils of thick grain, cookie dough, he thought, pushed their way out from under his nails, flapping a bit like Spanish moss in a breeze. They extended down to the grubby floor of his basement apartment. When they reached the floor, the tendrils flowed back upward, unseen, through his fingers, burning a bit like fluid through an IV tube, traversing through canals in his fingers and arms he never knew he had, or never had before. That morning, he'd made 5 strands of finger dough rise up and vibrate like slithering snakes. The egg-shaped black orbs underneath his shoulders bore no faces, but he knew they were directing their attention to him. His nails painlessly burst open with appendages the color of cobalt, the shape of carrots, the texture of glass. Then they retracted and his old nails were there again. The constituent parts of his new body had explained everything to him. They'd done that trick with his nails because it knew he'd think it was cool. It made him feel comfortable. Wolverine, bitches! Schnicked. Sometimes dreams do come true. He stared at the restaurant. Kind of pathetic, he thought. All this power for such an unworthy target. In movies, to show a character is good, mature, and above it all, the character will have the opportunity to take revenge and get his justice, and then, nah, pass. Like saying, you're beneath me. Like anyone would really do that. That's why those are movies, and this is real life. 2 pillars of crooked bone protruded up out of his shoulders, tapped 3 times, click, 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 crossed each other like whirling scimitars, and popped back into place. That was cool, like he was a super soldier or something, a samurai. He wanted an adjustment to his face, something to scare the shit out of people right before he killed them. Wanted his mouth to spread out like the wings of a manta ray, little suckers and teeth embedded into his cheeks. But he couldn't will that for some reason. He went down on his knees like this was the culmination of a lifelong quest, like he was nothing but a modest servant fulfilling the calling of a higher power, seeking to set order to a universe gone wrong. His elbows shook and clicked and chattered like they were filled with rattling dice. This was going to be great. This was going to be awful. He forced himself to complete the task as quickly as possible. There wasn't even that dreadful couple of seconds of anticipation when the bathroom door closes and the other occupants enjoy their last seconds of calm before the embarrassing, multi-tonal timbre of horrific noises. Between the time he closed the stall and the time he started, someone listening in from outside could be excused for wondering if he'd even had time to take his pants off before the wholesale slaughter began. His cacophony of embarrassing bathroom noises right then were bad enough that he wanted to ask his father about stomach problems running in the family. It sounded like an old man coughing up his soup. But oh God, what relief. He didn't even look in the toilet afterward. That was a first. Maybe that signaled something, growing up, step one into overcoming his weird phobia and this obsession of his. The bowel movement had gone on for so long and with such intensity that he half expected the contents to ascend vertically and carry him straight up to the ceiling, like Scrooge McDuck astride his overflowing lucre. With his bowels released, he felt a dormant gurgle of hunger pangs, as if the body stored pre- and post-digested food in the same area. Pro tip to remember, whatever you do, do not, under any circumstances, come out of the bathroom and mention that you've just become hungry. He made sure he was as clean as possible, which accounted for his excessive flushing. There were certain tips and tricks he lived by. One of them was a commitment to being a devoted over-flusher. He flushed so much whenever he used the bathroom that he worried that one day some environmentalist would overhear him and accuse him of wasting water. "Fuck off, go after someone who uses a humidifier." He already had his riposte prepared. Better to be safe than sorry. The only thing worse than having to be occupied in a toilet stall on a date is to be identified as the person responsible for clogging the toilet. He always flushed post-movement and then after every two or three toilet paper deposits. He figured that should be common practice, though more often than not, someone sharing the bathroom with him when he was washing his hands at the sink would give him a sideways glance, born of curiosity, of this unassuming man who deemed it appropriate to flush 3 to 4 times. What horrors had taken place behind those closed doors, he imagined them thinking. He could nod in agreement with his green friends and like articles online about the need for conservation, but a small plot of virgin Amazonian rainforest was torn asunder for the exclusive use of his asshole. Oh my God. He felt the expected stimulus one expects while wiping, but outside his ass, not inside, there was a sensation that should not be. While parting his matted posterior hair, there was, enmeshed within and between, the tactile sensation of plowing through a nugget of hot mud. No, no, it can't be. The human body couldn't allow this, no matter how hairy or overgrown he was back there. Millions of years of human evolution should provide for, at the very least, the human body not providing its own hair hammock for feces to rest in. Oh my God. This date was over. It just had to be. How could he recover from this? And no matter how diligently he worked at cleaning himself, could he ever be sure? Any time she wrinkled her nose or smelled her entree, could he rest assured that she was not aware of the rancidity wafting between them? How many times would he need to check his feet to make sure no feces-encrusted toilet paper dangled from his shoes? Or, God, worse, that there were no smelly remnants on his clothing? It wasn't fair. They were so aligned. It couldn't be. It's just not fair that this was to befall him on this day, on this date, with this woman, who otherwise would be so perfect for him. He was a good person who tried. He was good-looking, 6'3", broad-shouldered, and well-groomed. But this was unrecoverable. This was a dumpster fire. This was shitting the bed. No, worse, shitting yourself. Hoodie up over his head like a cloak, arms outstretched in the middle of the dining area, Alexander stood between tables. A server he didn't recognize leaned to the right, carrying a jug of ice water. He intuited that she rolled her eyes as she made her way around him, made a vowelless expression and a face reading, "Some fucking people." That insta expression that servers made whenever they were briefly interrupted in their duties, that immediately dissipated as they continued their mad scramble dash that was the dinner time rush. "Sorry," he said meekly, instinctively cowered, and immediately regretted it. "Excuse me? Everybody!" he bellowed. "Everybody!" he called out again, this time pointing down at himself while he spoke, as if it wasn't clear where the focus of the attention should be. "Everybody! Now that I have your attention, in our life and times, there comes a time when enough is enough, when there's only so much you can take." Oh my God, oh my God. He scrubbed at himself, that hopeless scrubbing you do when you get a fresh stain on a new white button down, and you know it won't work, but just hope it does this time. He even ran out and dotted toilet paper with sink water. He was, quite literally, rinsing his ass out while on a date. The restaurant-goers looked at Alexander blankly. Some checked in for the beginning of his spiel, concluded it was something they wanted no part of, shook their heads, and went back to their meals. Crazy panhandlers in restaurants now? Others kept their gaze, curious but hesitant. Other tables chatted excitedly about the upcoming unexpected show.
"Only so much you can take. This place, this restaurant, it's treated me so badly, so unjustly."
"Save it for Yelp," a girl's voice rang out from the back. Laughter. "Quick, someone get that guy a refill," someone else shouted from the same vicinity, his joke not landing as well as the Yelp girl's. Alexander paused, then continued.
"How much injustice, how much embarrassment, how much wrongness is one person expected to take?"
"So what he's asking is, who's coming with me?" More laughter. He heard competing laughter and interpretations from the audience, some people repeating the line in a Jim Brewer space cadet haze, others adopting the original version's pathetic, intense neediness.
"What justice is..."
He felt overheated and small, pathetic, even in his moment of glory. Bryce continued to clean himself off. He disentangled some small pebbles, shards of sharp, crustified shit that reminded him of cleaning out specks of glass from a broken light bulb. Had there been times when he felt discomfort while sitting, thinking maybe he was sitting on his keys, when in reality it was the gravel-like friction of accumulated shit debris? Could such a thing be possible? Could it be possible that he was someone who showered every day, made reasonable efforts to live up to the basic standards of hygiene, yet found himself in such a situation? Come to think of it, anal hygiene and cleanliness is something no one ever taught him or talked to him about. He remembers being a little boy and complaining about being itchy back there, and his mother explaining how you needed to make sure you're clean back there, otherwise the stuff, as she called it, back there will make you itch. Were there other life lessons he didn't know about? Should he be clipping himself back there, much the way some men clip their pubes? Should he get a dedicated razor? No one laughed. No one catcalled anymore. Not after he covered his face with his hands, gnawed on his fingers, and split and flung wildly as much liquid outpourings as he could. The response started as laughter and coursed swiftly into horror. "Jesus fucking Christ," someone said.
"Manager? Manager, someone get the manager! This isn't funny! I'm having a pleasant meal! This isn't the time for this performance art!"
someone stammered. The restaurant had windows that allowed some of the remaining natural light to stream in. On the upper corner, where the ceiling met the wall, hovered a red, humanoid creature. It made its entrance without fanfare, without acknowledgement. Just slowly, someone spotted it and pointed it out to someone else, who pointed it out to someone else, until the restaurant was abuzz with excited chatter and cackles, but of the kind that's obviously tense. A loud scream or shriek would put people over the edge.
"Ah, ladies and gentlemen and assorted assholes of all types, our first guest!"
Alexander stretched out his hands like a celebrity television host.
"For my first trick, a blast from the past, a special guest from Ghouls and Ghosts. I'm sure some of you stupid hipsters remember that game, right?"
The creature was just there, as if treading water, but in the air. It stood maybe 4 feet tall, but that was hard to tell, as it was not standing upright. It had deep red, rough skin, with light blue bracelets on both ankles and on both wrists, and oversized gray bat wings, the breadth of which probably matched the creature's height. The color coordination was odd and unexpected, and was the subject of a couple of quick observations and jokes. What also caught everyone's eye was its nudity. Other than those bracelets, it was entirely naked, yet it had no discernible genitalia, but only a rounded nub, like a Ken doll. It moved, but inorganically, in a pattern. Its short, hooked arms and legs kicked in and out, its wings flapped rhythmically, but there was absolutely no variation in the pumping, neither of its limbs nor its wings. It was on auto-repeat, and it just hung there, in space, with no whooshing of air or sound coming off its flapping, Its face was rough, its mouth a perplexing gash somewhere between grimace and smile, and its nose was bulbous and uncomfortably hooked. It just stayed up there, pumping its limbs, pumping its wings. Someone clapped and hooted.
"Yeah!"
a crowd of guys yelled.
"Do Mario next!"
a girl who knew nothing about video games yelled, the equivalent of yelling Freebird.
"Bowser!"
"Bowser!"
Alexander yelled back in a pitch and intensity that was all wrong for jocularity.
"What else do you retards want?"
Somehow, more than the grisly display and unexplainable creature flying overhead, the use of the politically incorrect term retard did the most to signal to the crowd that something was dangerously off course.
"So, if you remember, when the knight in Ghouls and Ghosts got hit, his armor would fly off. And when he got hit without armor, he turned into bones. Let's see what happens if one of you morons gets hit."
The red demon assumed a sitting position and floated in the air, moving horizontally toward the center of the restaurant, still well above all the diners. This was too much now, and a huge exhalation went out from the crowd. Now could be heard, "Oh my God!" and loved ones clutching each other tighter to reveal that they were scared. This was no longer fun or funny. The creature's expression never changed. It moved its arms in a robotic, almost jaunty fashion, and swooped down in an arc like a pendulum. Still flying, but now at ground level, people shouted and shrieked. Some were stunned and confused at how, despite being closer, they could not make out much more detail about this unwanted guest. It hovered close to the ground in a straight, uninterrupted line, as if it was taking off on a runway. Then its direction arced as if it was taking off to the ceiling again. It made its way toward a table of three, and it collided with the unfortunate, most smartly underdressed hipstery kid of the bunch. Most people instinctively averted their gaze from what they suspected would be the undignified, chaotic crunch and tumbling of bones and bodies. The creature didn't even register the collision, the arc of its flight completely unaffected. The poor kid alt, though. He registered the blow, toppled backwards off his chair, and quite literally exploded into chunky fragments. Tables overturned, the red sauce and the pasta appetizer got a new thickener, the drinks new bloody garnishes.
"And so it begins!"
Alexander worked himself into a frenzy, a rabid dog. No, worse than a rabid dog. He contorted his back and his joints, headbanging, a man in perpetual spasm. He gnawed and raged, tore and ripped. A substance the shape of bologna and the consistency of caviar extended out from his breast. He tore it out and threw it to the horrified onlookers, where it somehow splattered, shattered, and rolled into four separate pieces, their momentum never stopping, picking up speed, the velocity of their movement the same whether it rolled or used its still growing but still powerful lunging legs. "Four pieces of sentient, spam-like meat," Crystal thought, the only one of her party able to process what was enveloping before her. But those thoughts were gone when the creature was fully upon her, squishy and suffocating, and there was nothing sharp about it. Then, unbearable pain and her top half skidding along the greased floor, recognizing her separated lower half by the tight, theory jeans she'd just bought yesterday. A star-faced mole jumped atop the sentient strips of meat and hissed. It dipped the prongs of its face into her bloodied wound, and, contented, it scampered off to further its feasting. More and more of his minions were assembling. An army. An army of one, he thought. And that seemed right, since they originated from within him, from the pieces he tore off himself, from the sheer determination of his iron will. A floating pineapple of eyes. The star-faced mole. That was an inventive one. A McDonaldland grimace and a Viking helmet. Head crabs. Bodies ascending and descending and dividing into uneven quarters. The chaos and abandon was too much and too unplanned. He wanted to hold some of the chaos in abeyance, understand exactly what he was working with, try to plan certain punishments for certain people. Truth was, he just acted. He had no idea what he could be conjuring up. Hell, he didn't even initially plan for any of the customers to get hurt. It just happened. a sentiment he'd accepted as he stared at the fresh corpse of a hipster beardo, eyes bugged out, a white gelatinous square the texture of tripe wrapped tightly around his mouth. Why did he feel bad, of all things? He should move beyond that. That should be beneath him. Morality was for other people. Out of the corner of his eye, he recognized Manny, the head chef, bolting straight out from the kitchen and toward the front doors. He extended an open hand toward his closest minions, dark brown, round creatures the size and shape of bowling balls, covered in cross-cutting, viciously sharp quills. They even rolled like bowling balls. Three of them were rapaciously chewing on what, at some point, had been a face. In a moment of accentuated detail, he saw one cleanly chomp off several fingers from a disembodied hand, make an awkward face following the crunch of what must have been a wedding ring, constrict its face as it made a hearty swallow, and reveal what may have been a smile. "Critters!" he called them unthinkingly. "Attack!" And he pointed at a fleeing Manny. Manny turned back for the briefest of moments, saw the finger directing the attack upon him, and resumed bolting, emitting something like a guttural yelp. The creatures continued their chewing. The three of them formed almost a triangle. They shook while they ate, like gulls imbibing live fish. "Attack!" he directed again. The creatures continued unabated and undisturbed. Even among the ruckus, Alexander heard a loud smack and knew it was Manny falling hard. His vision was obscured by booths and tables, but he distinctly heard Manny yell, a yell that lessened in intensity and volume until it sounded like it was coming somewhere more remote, maybe underwater. Alexander adjusted his position to see what had happened, to find a hazy outline of Manny, visible through the translucent sheen of whatever jellyfish-like creature he'd disappeared into. The creature sat with the repose of a giant toad, even as protesting hands pushed tiny, stalagmite-like ripples through the base of its head. A few seconds, some adjustment, and ambiguous motions later, the movement stopped, the mass of what was Manny subtracted like sand from an hourglass. Luck smiled upon Alexander. How could he be in the wrong when everything was now so right, when fate convened to give him these powers and make sure his harassers got their just rewards? He'd commend that creature, promote it somehow, even though he knew not what that meant and feared they cared not a whit for or about him. He saw a tall blonde girl outside the restaurant, looking in, pounding on the glass, sheer terror and desperation on her face. She pounded and lost resolve, descending for a moment into a crescendo of tears as her friends were digested before her. "Get her!" he yelled as a general command. If there was any discernible change in the arrangement of the battlefield, he was unaware. "Get her! Make sure she does not escape!" Somehow, the woman outside clued into what he was saying or directing and ran. She escaped out of sight. "Get her! You let her escape!" He pondered how many other people had simply escaped and concluded it must have been many. This was chaos, and he and his minions appeared to be on different wavelengths. He wanted swift, organized justice. They seemed content just being fed. "More food! Food! In the kitchen! Plenty of food! Live food!" He hadn't taken a tally on how many of his minions had been wrecking havoc, but he suspected plenty had left the restaurant already to satisfy their own devices. There was certainly less commotion than when he started. He looked for the star-faced mole, that was his favorite, the one he was most impressed with, and couldn't locate it. There were panes of broken glass and open doors. As if to make the abandonment all the more obvious and embarrassing, there was a green, viscous trailway of slime leading from the center of the dining room straight out of the front entrance. The critters were still here. One was face deep, or perhaps body deep, since the entire creature seemed to consist solely of a face, its sonic-like quills cresting out of the inner cavity of a corpse like a chest shark. Another sat on its haunches, its stubby legs sticking out, not a care in the world, perhaps even vibrating as it burped through its meal. He walked closer to the critters, they for some reason becoming his lodestar, a feeling of oppressive ineffectuality gathering in his chest. He accidentally kicked the soft frame of an oversized slug. its delineated head raised and twisted 360 degrees. Its head was that of a horrifyingly real, too scaly, and too green hypnotoad. Its head lowered down, and it ignored him, though a weird, ambient slushing noise emanating from its midsection became temporarily louder. He feared it would strike him. He tried to look casual and avoided eye contact. What have we here? Wedged in the corner underneath the table where the booth meets the wall, a quivering, shivering young lady. Well, not that young, more like young-ish, maybe in her 30s. He assumed a squatting position, reached underneath, felt the firm, impressive outline of her lower body, and began dragging her out. She screamed and kicked, jamming one of his fingers. It took him longer to pull her out than it should have. He wrapped both his arms around her ankles and pulled, but she was stronger than she let on and held onto the edge of the booth. His minions heard the tussling and turned in his direction, with the exception of the floating pufferfish, which continued staring vacantly ahead, drifting listlessly. He tugged hard, hard enough that her hands gave way and she slid on her back out from under the booth. He tugged so hard that he fell back, hard, on his ass, like an obese woman crashing through a lawn chair. Christ, he landed so hard, with such an emphasis on his ass, he half expected this was a comedy bit and he just landed in a pie or dog shit or something. From her back, she launched herself forward and rained punches down on the bridge of his nose. With his hands now covering his face, she took the opportunity and bolted up and ran. She shrieked, turned and surveyed the confusing, intimidating landscape. Overcome with nausea and sensory overload, soft, round organs, bright, streaky blood, violent, puncturing angles, she ran to the first opening that was unguarded, the kitchen.
Follow her! She ran into the kitchen! Follow her! There's more back there! Food! But don't eat her! I want her for myself!
Bryce looked into the mirror and sighed with a heavy heart. He checked his phone. 23 minutes. He had been in the bathroom for 23 minutes. What would overcome her first, he wondered. Her hunger from waiting, or her repulsion about wondering what could possibly take him 23 minutes in the toilet. Maybe her revulsion canceled her hunger out? Wishful thinking. He half expected to find out that she left. Maybe she thought he bailed. God, can you imagine that? Shitting for such an inhumanly long length of time that your date can rationally, plausibly conclude that it's more likely that you abandoned her than you were just fulfilling an unfortunate human need? Maybe it'd be better if she did leave. Less embarrassing, perhaps, than going out there and seeing her face and coming up with some small talk to deflect the 500-pound floating piece of shit in the punch bowl. He adjusted himself in the mirror and again liked what he saw. He looked good. The sweater fit him well. His skin was largely blemish-free, his recently shorn hair respectably stylish. He fake-smiled, sighed again, washed his hands like he was about to perform an appendectomy, and made his way out. He left the men's room, or whatever room he had turned into the men's room, turned right, and pushed open the sliding door that connected the bathroom area to the dining area. He pushed it part way open until it moved no further. He pushed harder, and it made a little bit of headway. Okay, be cool, he thought. The odds of being stuck in the bathroom are pretty slight. God, can you imagine that? As if a 20-minute sojourn into shitting wasn't conspicuous enough, he announces his return by being publicly stuck in the bathroom? He retained his composure and tried again, simultaneously pushing the door and trying to wedge himself through the opening. The door snapped back a little when he transitioned his energy from the pushing to the wedging, and it socked him in the lip as if throwing a quick jab. His nose and lip burned with that angry, unpleasant energy of an unexpected jolt, like when you smash your funny bone or, well, get hit in the face with a door. God, can you imagine if I'm bleeding now? Imagine that. Gone in the bathroom for 20-plus minutes and returned bleeding. It literally made him laugh. Maybe that'd be for the best. Maybe he could say he was mugged in there or something. Can you imagine launching a police investigation to save face? He laughed despite himself. He kept his head down and made a beeline for where he knew his table to be. He didn't see her sitting where she should be sitting, and he looked down and his stomach burned and sank. God, could it be possible that she actually did leave? The burning in his stomach became a stabbing, sinking feeling of despair. That idea didn't seem so funny anymore. He slipped on an outrageous pool of liquid and went bow-legged, then slipped forward and went down, hard. He landed on his left shoulder, splayed out on his left side, and closed his eyes. He was in some kind of liquid, water, he assumed, but it smelled bad, almost copper-like. Toilet water. Imagine that. Imagine I shit myself, spend 20 minutes in the bathroom, bloody my nose on the door, and then fall in fucking smelly water in front of an entire restaurant. Kill me. He closed his eyes. Just let me fucking die here. Let me close my eyes and never wake up. No one rushed over to help him up, and he didn't hear any exhalation of energy from the restaurant goers. No whoops or ohs or anything. Perhaps they were all in stunned silence, mortified on his behalf. He turned to his side and looked into what, yesterday, may have formed the base of a perfectly acceptable face. Plucked from its roots, it was now a garish, lopsided curlicue of bone, teeth, and sinew. He jolted and shot out a hand and, my God, the texture of the thing! It was emulsified. The base of it stayed put and sunk into itself. He screamed, stood up, and saw all that was before him. He said nothing and stared. Somewhere in the back of his mind, in the smarter part of his subconscious, he recalled a quote. One death is a tragedy. A million is a statistic. All this laid out before him, all deathly silent, but there. All these people and their derivative parts. The thick, wire-framed glasses of a guy he recognized had been sitting next to him. Several such glasses, actually. Clark Kent-style glasses had obviously been popular at this hipstery eatery. There were so many varieties. Broken ones, bloodied ones, some still dangling from faces. He registered the gallows humor, but didn't laugh. He just turned back around. He wanted to slowly walk into the bathroom and blow his brains out. But he didn't have a gun, and he couldn't move. He looked back over his shoulder. A green, hulking creature, gait like a gorilla, all strong shoulders and long arms, dragged the relatively well-preserved corpse of what appeared to be a teenage boy. The creature dragged the dead boy to a certain, inexplicable point, and then, with 3-foot arms outstretched, launched him up over the banister to the top floor of the restaurant. There wasn't the loud thud you'd expect, but rather a soft bristling of vegetation like the body had landed in a nest. The creature lumbered across the room, in no rush, to do the same with another body. Robin, he called out. Robin? Robin? Robin, are you here? If he'd thought about it rationally, he wouldn't have done it. There was no doubt this creature was already aware of his presence, and with that strength, could easily snap him in two. The creature registered his presence for a second or two, and then dumbly continued its task. It had a simple, unamused simian look. Robin! He yelled again, this time pivoting in place to yell it across the entire dining hall. Robin, are you here? He heard a loud, cracking pop from outside. The sound that Hollywood told him was a handgun. Jesus. Somehow, the sound of something so concrete and familiar, thank you, Hollywood, and God bless America, brought him back to reality. He scanned the bottom floor as comprehensively as he allowed himself to, and saw no sign of Robin or her clothes or anything else identifying. His search became so frantic that, instead of regarding with a sense of wonder the oval slug possessing the face of a monstrous toad, he thought of it as nothing more than a fat, wasteful impediment, an inconvenience. Maybe she ran away. Maybe she got away. He walked toward the closet door, which opened to a hallway which led to the kitchen. Did you ever see the movie Critters? Well, did you? She nodded, the nod of a trapped victim buying time with a terrorist. She was pinned in the corner, surrounded by this bubbling facsimile of a man, supported by his flanking fan of four vicious-looking squat creatures. They did look like the creatures from that movie Critters. That was the first thing she thought of, too. Krites, they were called in the movie. They look just like him. Alexander pointed this out to his captive audience. The creatures chattered and stood there, their small limbs and tiny hands folded, their large mouths, row after row of sharp and grinding teeth, their cherry-red cat-like eyes. "Are you a Krite?" He turned and spoke to the nearest creature. "Are you a Krite? Is that where you're from? Is that what you're called? I loved that movie as a kid. That has to be what you are." None of them seemed to respond, maintaining their deathless, voracious gaze. The only difference among them was one of them breathed with a heavy wheeze. "Someone call the prop department," he joked to no one. He turned back to face her. "So, what do you think of all this?" he asked her. She shook her head, unsure of how to answer, but knowing that she had to keep the conversation going. The more he viewed her as someone to talk to, the less likely he was to kill her. It was hard to look at him. The area around his lips looked like bubble wrap fashioned out of pastrami. "I'm trying to identify all the monsters, I guess, that are here. I think I saw one of those plants from Super Mario Brothers before. You know, those red and white plants that come out of the green pipes. That was cool." He smiled, and it was horrible. A mass of bleeding caviar rearranging itself into a human expression. "I feel my face changing, and I'm happy about it. I wanted to change my face, and I feel like it's happening. I'm getting stronger. I must be. I don't understand why it's so gross, though. I don't like that. Why does it always have to be so gross? Why can't it be something beautiful? I can't even see it, but I can just tell it's gross, the way it feels." He looked down at his hands. They were wider and broader than human hands should be, and it was harder to demarcate the separate fingers. There was a hazy filament of hair catching the light. "What should we do, guys?" he asked the four critters standing behind him. Funny, they looked like cheesy props, almost. They looked flat and unreal, like projections on a screen. They didn't seem fully textured, like there were important details missing, like how they smelled. That's right, come to think of it, they didn't seem to have any discernible smell. "Even when my fantasies come true, I'm not in control, I guess." His face had changed so much that his expressions weren't readily classifiable. "So, what should we do? To be honest, I don't really want to kill you. I only wanted to get revenge on the people who worked here. And not really. I don't know. I think I just wanted to scare him. I wanted to scare the manager, but I didn't even see him today. I don't really know what to do, to be honest." She nodded slowly, as if she was his confidant and was really objectively weighing his statements. "I understand. It all just got out of hand. It's not your fault. You didn't want any of this to happen. Can you let me go? I won't tell anyone, I promise. No one would believe me anyway." "No, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I mean, I understand what you're saying, I do, and no one would believe you. But I imagine the police are already on their way, and they'll believe what they see with their own eyes." "You can't. Yes, you can do that, but just let me leave." "No, I'm sorry," he said, but slowly, with the weighing gravity of a henpecked father deciding whether to let his kid borrow his car, like he was asking for forgiveness as the subtext of his refusal. "Then, what are you doing with me here?" "I don't know. I like you being here, I guess." He took a step closer to her. He was perhaps a foot away now. "I don't know. I don't plan on, like, I don't know. I like your company, though. Do you think maybe you could take your shirt off, actually? I don't know. It might cheer me up or help me think." She swallowed hard. "What? If I do, do you promise to let me go?" Her attention turned to the entryway, and she almost shouted with excitement. There stood Bryce. He just stood there, in plain sight, as if he came to a threshold after entering the doorway and couldn't come any further. He was surveying everything he could, this horror show before him and the structure of the kitchen he found himself in. Bryce was bad at estimates, but he was maybe 6 feet away from them and felt the heat of boiling water and active pots and pans. Underneath torn vegetables, he saw metal shapes. Hopefully, they were knives. It took an additional beat for the bubbling mass that was Alexander to turn and face him. He looked disappointed, and the air was tense with something other than murder, as if Alexander was an ex-boyfriend trying to keep his composure and sizing up her new lover. As if on cue, another person of sorts joined them in the kitchen. From another entryway, this one leading from the cold storage room, came another form, making its entrance known with a sound approximating wet towels dropping onto the floor. Its entire aura was imbued with stagnant water, even when it wasn't moving and stood there, staring. There was the sound and scent of tepid water, of slipperiness. It stood about 5.5 feet, not particularly imposing, on 2 webbed feet, with its webbed hands extended slightly horizontally, as if planning to give someone an exaggerated hug. The details of its body were scarce, except that it shone a sickly form of green and its body was slick and long, almost like a seal. The details of its face were even worse, almost as if Bryce needed prescription glasses in order to understand what he was seeing. The face was vaguely humanoid. There were lumpen masses that might have been tentacles, but it was too indistinct to make out. There didn't seem to be any mouth. Alexander pointed at the new visitor. "Zombies ate my neighbors. It has to be, right?" He wished he'd actually seen Creature from the Black Lagoon, because he knew the fish monster from Zombies Ate My Neighbors was inspired by that movie. This was a poor, low-budget facsimile. "Man, I haven't played that game forever, but it has to be." He wished he'd actually seen Creature from the Black Lagoon, because he knew the fish monster from Zombies Ate My Neighbors was inspired by that movie. This was a poor, low-budget facsimile. "Man, I haven't played that game in forever, but it has to be." Bryce seized the opportunity. He grabbed the nearest pot by the handle and lifted it high over his head, ready to bring it down like a hammer. It was heavier than he expected, and the lid fell off with a heavy clunk and narrowly missed his foot. As he arched the pot over his head, he realized why it was so heavy. It was half filled with boiled water. Miraculously, he lifted the pot fast enough and tilted it just right so the water emptied out harmlessly behind his head, although he felt steaming water residue on the bottom of his jeans. Still moving on impulse, he leapt toward Alexander and swung the pot down as hard as he could on top of Alexander's head. Bryce hit him square on the forehead. The impact wasn't as dramatic as he expected. There was the forcible collision with bone, but also something softer, bone wrapped in marshmallow. Still, Alexander went straight down on his back. The critters retained their look of voracious detachment, their mouths still open, their cat eyes still frighteningly red, yet immobile. Then, thunk, Bryce felt a reverberation through the pot. A cruel-looking quill was vibrating half-deep into the metal. Jesus, he'd gotten lucky again. If he hadn't been holding the pot at around face level, that quill would have gone straight through his windpipe. One of the critters changed its position and was back on its hind legs. So that was the fucking bastard culprit. "Fuck you!" Bryce screamed, this time swinging the pot like a tennis racket at the big, wide target that was the critter's face. Now that was satisfying. The impact literally lifted the round, fat ball of quills and teeth off the ground and sent it on a curving trajectory toward the stovetop. The other three critters hissed and growled and made high-pitched noises. Womp! The fish monster lashed out at one of the critters with its claws, and one swing was enough to take it out. It followed up with 3 identical strikes on the now clearly dead critter. It now looked at another one, but its facial expressions didn't change, and its movement was rote and almost mechanical. It swung back its arm again to make another horizontal strike, and, as insane as this all was, Bryce could not help but realize that this strike looked identical to the previous strikes, as if this creature only had a certain range of programmable actions and was doomed to a life of infinite repeats. A quill flew into the midsection of the fish creature. It flinched and flashed white for a brief moment and continued moving forward. It was struck with 2 more quills, and it flopped down and died, in a surprisingly efficient and unlabored death. 1 second, it was marching forward, then it was down on its back in a heap, and then it was simply gone. But that was enough time. When the firing critter turned around, Robin was already upon it with a sharpened kitchen knife. She sunk the knife into its fleshy stomach. Again and again and again she plunged her knife, and the screaming was almost intolerable, so reminiscent of a pleading, wounded dog or tortured cat. Bryce felt almost sick to his stomach, as if they'd just done something unrepentantly inhumane. She stopped stabbing it only when it rolled onto its back like a cartoon tortoise. The last critter launched itself at Bryce. It made no gestures that indicated it was about to leap. It was just suddenly in the air. It bit hard into whatever its teeth came in contact with. Unfortunately for it, that whatever was Bryce's trusty hammer pot. The critters looked almost like giant brown koosh balls, and this one played the part as it soared through the air. It landed with aplomb against the industrial-strength refrigerator door. The creature took a moment to regain itself, then shook itself into convalescence. It bit at the air for whatever reason. Robin ran beside the struggling creature, kicked it toward the refrigerator door, and slammed the creature between the door again and again and again, to the point where she was actually able to close the refrigerator door fully, while the top part of the creature thrashed and chomped futilely, emitting the same disturbing, dog-like shriek of its stabbed brethren. It spasmed a couple of times, and when the door opened back up, there was a pool of green blood and a distorted mass of gore between its stubby legs and the rest of its body. Bryce ran over to Robin and pulled her back from the refrigerator. She relaxed in his arms for a moment, then grabbed the pot, now substantially dented, and ran over to the critter that had first shot the quill at them and which Bryce had subsequently punted across the room. It lay prostrate on its back. From viewing just the fuzzy back of it, it was almost cute. Its back looked like an innocent woolly brown bush, but such concerns didn't slow her down at all. She smashed it again and again and again. 3 times she smashed it until she was sure it was dead.
"Robin, I'm so glad you're alive!" He ran toward her and noticed that green fish creature, it had been here before, right? Where could it have gone? It was gone, just disappeared. There was a green fish-like creature thing there before, right?
Right. You're not crazy.
She spoke slowly and deeply, catching her breath. Her tone was too brusque, not as warm and relieved as he'd like if he had his druthers. He held onto her back, coaxing and comforting her.
Wait, there's still him,
she signaled toward the increasingly humanoid form of Alexander. His forehead and the area between his eyes were deeply bruised, and a lightning bolt scar made its way down between his eyebrows. Harry Potter, Bryce thought randomly. Under the bruises, the monster's face had become identifiably and unremarkably human.
We need to make sure he's dead. We can't take any chances. He caused all of this out there. He's a monster, a literal monster.
Agreed, Bryce nodded. He took the pot by the handle, hesitated, gave it back to her, and took a butcher knife. From the way he held it, you could tell he didn't have a lot of experience cooking chops for himself. He choked up on the handle, holding it more tightly, resolutely. Okay, he said, and moved in closer to the recumbent body. Alexander was splayed on his back, arms spread on an invisible crucifix. Bryce prodded the shape in the left ribcage. The shape groaned, but did nothing else. This would be a lot easier if the guy shocked back to life or something, and he could get this over with in the heat of the moment. I think he's out cold. Bryce knew that sounded stupid. If he were watching this on a movie screen, he'd be screaming, "Fucking come on, man, do it!" and then complaining loudly that the witless character was asking for it when things inevitably went awry.
No, we can't allow him to escape. He needs to die. You saw what he did. He killed all those people. He was going to kill me. He was going to rape me, even. He caused all these things. It's a fucking massacre out there.
She stopped herself from breaking down completely, but exhaustion was clearly eroding her. I know. He got down on his knees and straddled the body, chopping knife at the ready. He didn't know how to bring the knife down. A hard thwack into the skull as if it were a watermelon?
Can you give me, like, a cutting knife?
She brought him a sharpened blade, used for fine cuts, he thought, which took on a sinister connotation. He put the blade to the bastard's throat. It helped to think of him like that, a bastard, a murderer. He killed all those people. You fucking bastard. You fucking piece of shit murderer. No response.
You fucking killer! How could you?
He was speaking unnecessarily loudly. Can't this guy wake up or move or something so he could kill him and pass it off to himself as self-defense? He wished he had a gun, although he'd never shot a gun before in his life and wouldn't even know what to do with one.
Do it!
Bryce gracelessly pushed the blade into where the center of the man's throat should be. He envisioned a tactile slice, one quick slash, a controlled seepage of blood, and that's it. Misfire. He put only a quarter of the blade in and found resistance. Grimaced. He was committing the throat-slitting equivalent of slowly tearing off a band-aid. Course-corrected and overcompensated, plunging the knife at an awkward angle. Blood sprayed wildly. The knife was partially buried and obscured, like he dropped the blade into a cooling cake.
Oh, God! He's dead. He's dead. He has to be dead.
He stood up, covered in warm, coppery blood, the opening of the wound actively gurgling. They stood there, both panting. Several wordless moments passed between them. It was over, he felt. This was a natural concluding point. The curtain to fall, the credits to appear. The weight of the whole day made itself evident. A feeling of nausea and frazzled disconnection came over him, and he fell to the floor. She bent down at first to maybe help him back up, but collapsed upon him in what became an affectionate embrace. Eventually, the outside din made itself physical. They were soon being assisted by more police and emergency officers than he'd ever seen before. The conflict wasn't over exactly, and he was oddly grateful for that. He half expected everything to just disappear, and for the authorities to find just this hideously slaughtered, disfigured body in the kitchen, the placid presence of undisturbed restaurant-goers undercutting his entire cockamamie story. But that was selfish, he thought. It would be better if this was a dream, an unreality. Then there wouldn't be all these bodies. There was a shootout that took place out of sight, and one shooting directly in front of them that was particularly shocking for being so abrupt and pathetic. The gorilla creature from before moseyed out from somewhere, spotted the officers, and grunted. It picked up and threw a nearby body part at them, apathetically, as if following a preset program. It went wide, wide enough that no one needed to dodge. One of the officers fired. The beast clutched its left shoulder with its right hand, pivoted, groaned, and slowly walked toward the officers. Another officer fired, this shot low, around the groin. The creature repeated the movement as before, clutching its left shoulder with its right hand and groaning. Several more shots. The same movement, the same animation, and then the creature practically hopped backward to land on its back, where it outstretched its arms and its tongue and just stopped moving. Everyone stood, blinked, and no one said a word. A minute later, the beast was gone. There was one other lasting memory that stood out to him. A burly, mustachioed officer was speaking animatedly with his hands, giving directions to his cadre. He moved his hands in a chopping movement while he talked, like he was doing the Braves cheer. Suddenly, like a moray eel, a red and white spotted plant shot out of an unremarkable pipe against the wall, soundlessly chomped into his finger, and disappeared, finger and all, back into the pipe. Bryce and Robin were ferried out amidst the commotion, and they never stepped into the deer and fox ever again. Robin breathed heavily, and her breasts heaved metronomically. They showed nicely through what appeared to be a stylish, form-fitting white blouse. No, something more threadbare than that. He could clearly make out the contrast of the maroon bra she wore underneath. The disfigured man reached out toward her. His face was orange, puffy, and indistinct. The man pulled Robin forward. Her breasts pitched upward from the force and jiggled vigorously as she stopped short in his grasp. He grabbed around her, trying to dominate her, get leverage on her shoulders. The man squeezed one of her breasts painfully. She pushed him away, and his fingers were crumpled up within her shirt, so when she pushed, her shirt extended, exposing her deep décolletage. Bryce's erection flooded full and sharp, pressing hot against his pants. It was his first glimpse of her perky breasts, but also not, because underneath the dream, he registered that he knew what her breasts looked like. But there was something powerful and erotic about this sight, the thrill of a slip, the power and control of the image. He charged and knocked out the disfigured man with one straight blow. Bryce woke up next to Robin. Actually, next to her was not fully accurate. She was already half up and getting ready for work. He only saw her back. His stomach sank, and that was enough to know the vitality that radiated off her was limited to the dream world. The only thing that carried over from the dream world was his erection. He laid awake in bed while she prepared for the day. He felt her staring at him impatiently to get up. They often tried to leave for work at the same time, and there was something satisfying in staying in bed for a bit, the slightest form of obstinacy he could muster without overtly riling her. The covers were still over him, and he rested his hand on his privates, the erotic elements of the dream still in his mind. He looked up at her, brushing her hair. She looked back at him, looked away, looked back at him, and gave him a slightly annoyed look to show that she didn't see the point in breaking and maintaining eye contact. She wasn't going to give him a goofy or warm smile just because. She wasn't his cheerleader. He groaned and got out of bed and let his half erection jut out from his boxers. She didn't acknowledge it. He let it hang, untouched and unremarked upon. He felt he was making a statement of sorts. It had been almost a year since that defining date at the Deer and Fox. They'd lived together for the last 6 months, and they hadn't been physical with each other for the last two. "I'm gonna shower," he told her. "Okay. What time is it?" She looked at her phone and said in a phlegmy, impatient way, 8:30. No, 8:35. They normally wanted to be out the door by 9 a.m. so they could get into work sometime between 9:30 and 10 a.m. They were running late. "You don't have to wait for me, I guess."
"Yeah, I figured. I wish you would have told me earlier. I wouldn't have waited."
"I figured. Sorry. I can get in later than you, though." She made a testy sound.
"I know."
She was already halfway dressed.
"I left two wheat bars out for you if you want to bring them to work. I bought some for us, as I don't have time to make breakfast."
He mentally rolled his eyes and revealed this by giving a sarcastic, "woe is me, okie dokie" head nod. She maintained her frigid distance, zipped something up, and left the room. She was wearing a black bra and still needed to decide what to wear up top. He didn't want them to go to work like this, to leave and start the day on bad terms. "Hey," he offered as she came back in the room. Her chest jiggled a little when she stopped abruptly, and absurdly, it made him feel bad about himself and what was becoming of their relationship. He hadn't seen her chest bounce of her own accord, or his, for quite some time now. "Hey, what's going on with you?" That didn't come out right at all, and it was dreadfully obvious. No response. She had left the room. He heard the refrigerator door close.
"Nothing is going on with me,"
she huffed when she came back. She was eating Greek yogurt, the one where you mix the honey and yogurt. He could see the clump of honey on the spoon as she mixed it in.
"Come on, something's up."
She positioned her shoulders defensively and sucked the honey off the spoon in a desperate, rushed way. Funny, he didn't know there could be so much emotion conveyed through yogurt eating.
"Come on, I don't have time for this shit. I need to go to work. Can we not talk about this now?"
She usually didn't curse in reference to their relationship. "Well, I'd normally let it go, but this has been going on for a while. You just called our relationship shit, for one thing."
"Just don't. Let's just not talk about it now, okay?"
"Okay." She put the half-eaten yogurt down outside in the kitchen and walked to the closet to resume looking for a top. He felt an intense, burning sense of aggrievement that manifested in his chest and shoulders.
"Look, I want to talk about this. We always stop talking about things when you say so. We always go by what you say. You are important to me. This relationship is important to me, and I don't want to spend the whole day worrying about what's going on with us.
I want to talk about it now.
Look,
she started, her arms up as if she was literally stuck between a rock and a hard place and needed to wedge herself out. I have a lot to do today. You know my boss has been a major bitch recently, and I have a lot on my plate, and you can't stress me out this morning, and you can't make me late. Don't you understand that? Don't you get that? If you cared about me, you wouldn't fuck up my work or make things so difficult for me.
Oh no, here she was, getting worked up. She had a subtle way of shifting blame. Now he was morally responsible for her inability to control her emotions and what effect that may have on her workday. And why was it that she could call her boss a bitch, but God forbid he say that she was acting bitchy?
And you always make me late. I make breakfast for you and wait for you to leave with me, but no more. I can't do that anymore. You need to wake up earlier or let me wake up earlier and leave without you.
Okay, okay, he said, extending his fingers out in a soothing, de-escalating way. She was right about that, at least. He had made her late a couple of times, but he couldn't stand it when she made him feel morally responsible for stuff that was not his fault.
She was fully dressed now. He knew this was fucked up, but he had felt more sympathetic to her when she was half-dressed. She turned back to him, the last bite of yogurt in her mouth. Her expression wasn't good. It was largely frustration, with a sprinkling of the heavy sorrow inherent in carrying out a dreadful but inevitable task, like taking the cancer-ridden dog to the vet for the big sleep.
I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore.
Baby, don't be silly. This was going nuclear. He'd thought about it ending too, and there was excitement and freedom there, he knew. But no, he didn't want it to end. Not like this, not now.
She shook her head. Her eyes were closed, and there was a streak of wetness along her cheek.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't. I can't do this anymore. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I just don't feel like this is going to work.
Baby, come on. Let's just go to work and we can talk about this later.
No. I'm sorry. I just don't feel like I'm in love with you anymore.
Baby, he shot back like she said something wildly offensive and uncalled for.
Baby, you're just stressed. I'm sorry for bringing this up before work. It's my fault. It's my fault. You did nothing wrong. I'm sorry.
Usually, taking the blame and appearing plaintive was enough to escape long enough for her to calm down so he could live to fight another day.
No, she shook her head, eyes still closed. I'm serious. I've been looking into getting another apartment. I have one picked out already. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I should have told you before. I'm sorry, but I'm serious. I'm just not in love with you anymore. I fought it. I've pretended otherwise. I kept telling myself I loved you. You were a good person, and I appreciate what you did for me.
What I did for you? You mean saving your life? As in, I literally saved your life?
Yes, I know.
Look, honey, let's just talk about this later, okay?
Bryce, look, I'm sorry, but this has to be done. I'm sorry that this is the wrong time, but it's not working out. I'm sorry, it's not working out. I need to go to work now. I'm sorry, but it's not working out.
Baby, come on, you don't mean that.
I know what I mean. I know what I'm saying.
You can't possibly. We love each other. I'm your hero. You say it all the time. Why, you said it even like just last week when I fixed that cabinet for you.
Bryce, I shouldn't have said that. I like to make you happy. I'm sorry, I've been leading you on for some time, I suppose.
I quite literally saved your life. I quite literally am your hero. There were magazine articles written about us. I'm a fucking hero. I literally did everything I could to...
I know, Bryce, I know. I appreciate everything you did for me, and...
Everything I did for you. You mean preventing you from being raped and brutally killed? That's what you mean, right, when you say that? Bryce!
He didn't know what angered him worse, her breaking up with him, or her pat formality in doing it. She was like an executive getting through a difficult but predetermined business decision.
You have to... We have to be able to work this out.
I'm sorry, Bryce. I'm sorry.
I literally saved your life. I fucking saved your life! I know. I know. I feel terrible about this, but I'm sorry. I just don't feel... I think I'm in love with you. I mean, I know I'm not in love with you. I'm sorry, I just know I'm not in love with you, and...
You can't do this! After all I've done, after all we've been through!
It's not a judgment on you. I can't weigh the pros and cons of what you do or don't deserve based on what you did for me. This isn't a formula. I'm telling you I'm sorry. I have love for you. I so greatly appreciate everything you did for me.
Saving your life. Let's be clear about what I did. I literally killed a maniac for you. Literally killed monsters. Can you believe this? Literally killing fucking monsters, risking my life to kill monsters to literally fucking rescue you. And this is how I'm repaid for it.
Repaid? My love for you isn't a gift that you earn by achieving something for me.
Of course it fucking is. Of course it all is, his mind screamed in protest.
You don't win me. I'm not the prize.
You said you'd never be able to repay me. Do you remember that? You said you would never be able to repay me and that you would always be there for me. So, I'm asking you, please, please don't leave me. Let us work this out.
She breathed in deeply, as if quibbling with someone pointing in vain to a contract technicality. And in a sense, he was. And he knew it.
For everything I've done for you, for everything we've been through together, please, we have to work this out. I'm a good person. I'm a good person, and I'm sorry. I try. You know I try to be good.
He was crying, unmistakably and unabashedly.
You said it. You promised me that you'd be eternally grateful to me, that you loved me, that you'd never be able to repay me. So please, do this for me. Repay me this way. Don't leave me.
She didn't respond, not verbally at least, but she ploddingly shook her head. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We can talk about this later, but I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be mean, but I'm not in love with you. I'm sorry. It's not a thing I can work out. You are nice. You're a nice person. You'll find someone else to be nice to, someone else to love. I feel like I could be anyone. You just want to be loved so badly, I feel it has nothing to do with me. You just want me to cheer you on, to hug you and treat you... almost treat you like a dog or something. Like you're my son or something, and I'm your biggest booster, your biggest fan. I just can't. It's not...
I can't fucking believe you.
Don't. I can't do this now. I'm late for work. We can talk later.
I can't fucking believe this is how you... how you treat me! How you repay me!
Fucking repay you! He made a strategic mistake, he knew. Whatever welling of sympathy he'd evinced within her was gone. The course was now irrevocable.
Again, I'm not your princess that you rescued from the castle. You don't own me. You didn't win me, so just stop it. Just stop it and act like an adult. And if you want to get all technical with me and bring up every fact and detail from the past instead of focusing on how I've fallen out of love with you, then if I never met you, I'd never have even been in that restaurant to begin with.
Okay, whatever. He turned around to head back into the bedroom.
Whatever. I can't believe you. I can't fucking believe you.
He plopped back into the bed, the vertigo of sadness and uncertainty overwhelming him, seeping into the cracks of his rage. It felt better when these emotions were converted into rage, into indignation.
I'm a fucking hero, you know that? A literal fucking hero. I saved your life. I literally saved your life from God knows what, from getting eaten, from getting raped, from who knows. You had a different tune back then, let me tell you. You'd have been begging for me back then, and now look at you.
His conflation of pity and anger was mismanaged and received poorly, he could tell. And while he talked, she hedged, torn between consoling him and just storming out. She finally made a face of hands in the air disavowal, packed up her work things, and said she was leaving and they could talk tonight. He noted with some inner sadistic glee that she dotted her I's a bit as she left. He didn't want to move out or have her move out. Things weren't perfect, far from it, but he liked the life he had with her, liked the feeling he had with her. He looked at her and saw the best of himself. "I'm a fucking hero," he told himself again, this time into the pillow in a sulking way he'd perfected throughout his life, in a type of self-pitying performance art. It felt good to repeat that, and what he had done for her was undeniable. It could never be taken away. It was an assurance into heaven, into sainthood. He had always stayed faithful to her, even when the hero narrative went full blast following the media blitz. It felt good to be indignant and to hate. People forget that. There was something soporific about it, anesthetizing. Bad feelings sunk inward and were expelled outward, leaving him cleansed. "I'm a fucking hero," he consoled himself again, burning up into the pillow. "I'm a good person, and I deserve better than this. I deserve to be loved and treated better. I deserve to be with someone who appreciates me. This isn't how things are supposed to end." You've been listening to I'm a Good Person, I Mean Well, and I Deserve Better by J.R. Hamantaschen. J.R. Hamantaschen is a writer of short stories, having released several collections, including A Deep Horror That Was Very Nearly Awe, With a Voice That Is Often Still Confused But Is Becoming Ever Louder and Clearer, and You Shall Never Know Security. You can find collections of his works at Velox Books, www.veloxbooks.com. What a weird damn story, right? The 80s Nintendo kid in me is screaming in joy, and the part of me that lives in the real world is just, well, depressed, I suppose. But I gotta say, I love flipping the old trope on its head. To quote the great sage and imminent guru Keanu Reeves in Speed, "I have to warn you, I've heard relationships based on intense experiences never work. And there's something refreshing about seeing that actually play out. Fantasy fulfillment stories are great, but it's nice to sometimes see that pre-packaged Funko Pop ending with all the gloss and veneer stripped away. Maybe I just like it when a character is weak and petty in the ways that we all strive to overcome. Helps keep us pointed in the right direction." Well, now that I'm done philosophizing about a story involving picking shit out of your ass hairs, I suppose it's time to close out this episode. I'll be back next week with more Horror Hill for you, and I hope to see you all there. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.